When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Is this like, why is this here?
That's a pop screen or a windscreen.
It doesn't make our plosive sounds sound weird on the screen.
So it would sound like something.
You don't want an overly plosive Pelosi sound.
Pelosi! Pelosi!
Pelosi! Plosive!
We can undermine it if you want. That's fine.
Sibilance.
Severus Snape.
So that happened. This week, Indiana Governor Mike Pence took a fusillade of fire for having signed a new weird version of a Religious Freedom Restoration Act and attempting to pass that law off as something that didn't enshrine the right to discriminate against members of the LGBT community. Now, the walk back is on. Meanwhile, there's hope for millions of Americans living on the ragged edge of homelessness. Policymakers are having more and more success with this idea that maybe the best thing you can do to stop homelessness is to give people these things called homes. It's so crazy that it just might work in the most cost-effective way possible. Finally, this week we had April Fool's Day. You know, that one day every year where you can't trust anybody? Is this day a delightful opportunity for frivolity, or is it a terrifying period of publicly sanctioned emotional predation? Today, we will talk about our experiences of having been to the dark side of the so-called holiday. I'm Jason Linkins, here today with Huffington Post reporters Jen Bendery and Arthur Delaney. Nothing you are about to hear is a prank, unless this is a prank many, many years in the making. But here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. It's So That Happened, this podcast where we talk about things that happened. For the Huffington Post, I'm Jason Linkins. We're here in our Washington, D.C. studio, and I'm joined today by...
Jennifer Bendery.
And what do you do, Jennifer Bendery?
I cover Congress and the White House.
For the Huffington Post.
For the Huffington Post.
And with us today also is our good friend...
Arthur Delaney.
Who is senior something or other.
You can just call me a reporter.
You can just call him reporter. Senior dog haver.
The last time I did this was with Zach, and he said his title was senior economic reporter.
No.
Something. He said it very seriously.
Senior political economy reporter is
right.
His title.
Like, where did that come from?
You can't make fun of it enough.
Yeah. We decided that, I think we decided that my title was fart sauce. So. Did everyone have a nice week?
I had the stomach flu. So
what? Oh, did you?
Yep.
Didn't realize that.
I had that too. I probably gave it to you.
It was like 24 hours. I don't know where it came from.
People
are
lucky. Oh, what the hell am I doing in this room?
How about you, Arthur? How was your week?
It was an okay week.
So just okay?
Yeah, it was fine.
You didn't learn, grow?
No.
That's good. You know, it's not always important to learn and grow.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, the seed of a lesson was planted this week and later I'll look back and realize that I learned something. But I don't have any perspective yet. It's only the weekend.
It's still Thursday. It feels like we have more time to assess.
You're right. Perspective will settle in probably tomorrow at around around 3. And thanks for blowing up our spot, telling people.
It's actually not Thursday. It's just whatever day it is.
Are we supposed to be timeless in our podcast?
It's like when you write a story, you say what day it is, but you don't say like today.
We are
Thursday. It's whatever day it is that the listener is on right now.
Right. So it could be Tuesday of next week. It could be a year from now. We're hoping that like a year from now, someone discovers this podcast and is like, I'm going to go back and listen to the thing they did on April 2nd.
But they don't know what date it is. Now they do.
That's right. So we are in many ways, we are timeless. And yes, now I said specifically it was April 2nd when we recorded this. So, all right. Well, I guess this is a new Brechtian experiment in podcasts. You know, we've alienated you from the illusion of time. Okay, so but
deep.
Speaking of alienation, let's just talk about the biggest, craziest story this week. These
religious freedom restoration acts that have been enacted, or people have attempted to enact them, in Indiana and Arkansas, which everyone caught hell for, because in Indiana, at least, it sort of opened the door to discriminating against the LGBT community. Now, Jen, I know you're going to say, well, you've once again brought me onto the show to talk about gay stuff.
Gay stuff.
Right. But, you know, we actually do respect your expertise in a lot of areas.
Token.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for being here, though.
So a microaggression has been committed.
Yeah, so we've already microaggressed.
And it's April 2nd, and it's Thursday.
Stop. No, it isn't. Dear listener, do not listen to her.
Everything's worse. So, but today, after just a firestorm of controversy, Indiana's revised their law.
Today.
And now there are protections for LGBT.
I'm sorry. I like to keep time perspective.
All right, we're going to dispense with,
we can delete all of this.
We can't delete all of this. We've been talking for like 5 minutes. We can't just delete it. All right, what we can do is bravely move forward, okay?
I'm going home.
All right, we're all giving up on this already. No, but seriously, it's insane how quickly this everything broke in the story.
Yeah, and the governors of these states wanted do-overs.
Yeah, well,
they wanted to go back in time and undo their terrible mistake.
I'm not sure. I think Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, was sort of drag kicking and screaming into this. He was on George Stephanopoulos' show this week with George Stephanopoulos, which only sometimes has George Stephanopoulos. I don't watch it anymore, but I watched this segment. Where Stephanopoulos asked him 6 times to sort of just clarify whether or not this law, either by intention or accident, essentially enshrined the right of private business owners to discriminate against gay people.
And the reason he asked that question was because a conservative supporter of the law in Indiana said that that was exactly what it would allow.
He was totally excited about it. Like, Eric Miller of Advance America, which is a lobbying group in Indiana of some nature, like, actually was sort of like crowing about the fact is like, yes, we've actually get this benefit from this law. We no longer have to like cater gay weddings, blah, 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 blah.
Boom.
That kind of stuff. So it was like kind of awkward for Pence, who strangely enough had to like stood there and like pretend to not be against discrimination, when we know that Pence is like, you know, obviously has great antipathy for the LG. I can't get those 4 letters fast. So the gay community, the LGBT community, he has great antipathy for them.
He does. He has a terrible record. I mean, it doesn't take much to see it. Just look at his record in Congress. He's voted against all kinds of LGBT bills and LGBT rights bills. And he's spoken out clearly saying that he doesn't think that gay people deserve quote unquote special rights or, you know, he's a man of tradition and conservative value. I mean, all those buzzwords that you always hear.
Right.
That's him.
Now, the country has changed a lot from the time when he was a member of Congress, and the polls have shown much broader acceptance of gay people and gay rights.
Yeah. Even for younger conservatives.
And even people like Mike Pence have changed their tune. And he came out and said, I abhor discrimination. Acted like he was totally against it. But it seemed like a great instance where his record was extremely relevant and he couldn't get away with it.
He also said many times, and I was completely puzzled by this, he said many times that the RFRA, and he wrote,
the Religious Freedom Restoration Act,
was akin to the RFRAs. It's just fun to say RFRA. We can all agree on that, right?
Yeah.
RFRA.
RFRA.
It was akin to RFRAs that were enacted on the federal level by President Bill Clinton, then President Bill Clinton, and in the neighboring state of Illinois, which then in Illinois State Senator Barack Obama voted with the unanimous majority in passing. But he kept claiming it was the same. It was in a couple ways very, very different. One way is that it made prior RFRAs help people maintain their religious beliefs and actions the government took. The government always had to be a party to any lawsuit. This opened the door for private businesses to discriminate against individuals and there be, you know, and they were free of any legal repercussions for having done so, which made it different. And it made what they attempted to pass in Arkansas different. And I was weirdly disappointed by a number of normally sort of intellectually consistent conservatives who continued to maintain that, oh, it's the same law as was passed on the federal level.
That just makes my blood boil when I hear that.
And tell us, Jen.
I'll tell it, girl. I was watching MSNBC this week. Maybe you guys saw it. Ruth Marcus was on there.
Yes.
And it was like the most ridiculous exchange I've seen in a long time. Luke Russert was hosting whatever show that was. And maybe it was Now.
Yeah.
And they just had it back and forth, you know. So what's going on in Indiana? And she said, well, I don't, you know, I feel for Governor Pence. Because his law is just the same as a federal law that Bill Clinton signed in 1993. And it's just like 19 other states' laws. And Luke Russert was like, okay, great. Well, thanks for coming on. And that was the end of the segment. I was like,
and that is a typical way that I think supporters of these laws in the current political context are just throwing up dust.
Can we also just say that the sheer existence of a clip between Ruth Marcus and Luke Russert is in and of itself a sign of America's intellectual decline.
Oh, low blow.
Listen, no, fair blow, fair blow. In the Washington Post, actually, some guy from The Fix, which is a section of their website named after what a heroin sufferer feels on a daily basis that they need, actually published an article that said, you know, this is like 19 other laws. And, people were, like, tearing out their hair because it was like, wow, that's just fucking wrong.
Yeah, they're taking all this context, which often is a way to help explain something and bring about a better understanding. But it's context that does the opposite. For instance, when the federal RFRA was signed by President Bill Clinton, the purpose was to help accommodate Native Americans who had taken peyote and were then disqualified from unemployment insurance. They're saying this is part of a religious ritual, so you're burdening our First Amendment expression. Gay people weren't part of the story at the time.
Right.
The context of the Indiana law is nothing other than poking gay people in the eye. These laws have been promulgated in recent years in response to the advance of gay rights. And that is the correct context of what's happening.
Yeah,
right,
basically,
now.
Basically.
What I wonder is there how much of a need is there for these state laws? I know there's a federal law; it only applies to federal disputes. So, and the Supreme Court said, okay, the federal law doesn't apply to state disputes. So, states have their right to pass their own. If everybody in all the states mirrored the federal law for their state law, then that would be a justifiable law to pass? Are we at this point still, or do we not need this anymore?
This is another way that I think people have tried to cloud the issue by talking about the actual theoretical impact of these laws and how what they do is give an additional defense to people if they're defending themselves in a lawsuit alleging a civil rights violation. And, you know, all the states have different laws in the background of this. And in a sense, that conversation, while helpful, obscures the fact that the message is really important to the passing of these laws. It made me think of proposals to drug test the poor and unemployed.
Yeah.
Which are inevitably, in order to not be struck down by courts, have to be watered down so much that they don't really ever affect anybody. They never become law because of these hurdles. But that doesn't matter to the people who propose them. It's about the message.
Yeah.
It's about poking the safety net in the eyeball. And I think that is the important thing to keep in mind about these laws.
So do you think states should have them then? Like, I can't figure out personally, like, should states be interested in needing, like, do they need a state RFRA that, let's say, mirrors the federal law that everybody supported? I mean, what about that? What about a Native American who's unemployed, who uses peyote for religious reasons? Should he be able to, you know, point to a state RFRA law and say, hey, like, you can't deny me unemployment benefits because of my peyote use? I mean, it seems like in that one weird example, I agree. Like, that's not fair.
I feel like when the state passes a law like this, they kind of affirm the fact that they're aware that these are issues that they need to be prepared to contend with. You know, they don't get to. I think that it's possible that if there was just a federal law in the books, these things would happen throughout the states, and there would be contentious issues. The federal government would be called in to settle it. People would have to cite this law. And if you have a state law on the books, at least all lawmakers are sort of aware. It's like, oh yeah, we recently affirmed these same beliefs. The interesting thing, of course, about the federal RFRA is it still, you know, creates very thorny issues where accommodations need to be made between disparate groups. More sincere situations. You know, the Hobby Lobby case, which I think a lot of people, you know, objected the way it came out, it's still a pretty good example of like one of these situations where different groups of people and their sincerely held beliefs, they need to find some accommodation between the two of them. And in the Hobby Lobby case, it was a situation in which private business owners felt like the government was intruding on their rights. It wasn't this kind of case in which a private business, private for-profit business, and a customer were having a dispute. It was perceived, probably rightly, that the government was stepping in and someone needed to do something to clarify the position. Whether or not the clarification worked out to anyone's satisfaction, that's a different matter. But in this particular case, I think you're right. It is kind of just like sort of enshrining discrimination. And one of the interesting things, of course, is that we found out very quickly that when a state publicly proclaims themselves to be in favor of discriminatory business practices, lots of businesses say, okay, cool, you be you, Indiana. We're going to take our business elsewhere.
That was the big thing about right. this story was how the business community lashed out.
Yeah, and one of the things that stopped the Arkansas law dead in its tracks was when Walmart said, okay, nah, we don't support this law.
That was huge. And it is worth noting that business trumps ideology in this case because Walmart isn't exactly a pro-gay rights company.
No.
I mean, they've done plenty of things that have actively gone against LGBT rights in Arkansas and beyond. They just are more interested in their bottom line than they are in, blowback.
Asa Hutchinson really hung out Mike Pence to dry.
Yes, he did.
That was remarkable. And people were not expecting him to come out and say, I'm sending this bill back. I don't want none of that.
And my son told me that I shouldn't do this, which was also so fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, it comes back to that whole thing that the LGBT community always says, which is, we all know someone who's gay, right. whether they're in our family or friends or whatever, and you're going to start to see over time that people don't, they see the difference between the concept of gay rights and then, like, their brother being gay.
And more people are realizing that they already do know somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a conversation. I'd love to get your take on this. But my wife and I were talking about how interesting it is that it seems like, to a certain extent, the LGBT community, as far as, like, asserting themselves as deserving of equal rights, has, like, kind of, like, entered this sort of accelerated realm where they seem to have a widespread public support and have like closed the gap so quickly in ways that women in sort of like general sense in African Americans, say example, other ethnic minorities haven't done. And I have a theory about that. My theory being that like one of the issues is that to a lot of people who think, oh, I don't think I can get with gay people, it's still theoretical. They don't actually know gay people. They haven't met gay people. Once they do, most of them are like, oh, okay, they're cool. I don't know what I was thinking. You know, maybe I thought they're just like the sex was gross or something weird. But now that I know them, I'm just like, that's cool. They should be able to do that. Whereas someone who like actively wants – a person who actively thinks they want to oppose gay rights probably doesn't know any gay people because we can't observe gay people in nature the way we can a woman. Or an African American, like if you're against women's rights, if you're against you know civil rights for African Americans, I mean there's no theory about it. You're like in for a penny, in for a pound, and so it's a stronger kind of emotionally felt conviction discriminating against them. Do you feel like that might be what's driving the sort of accelerating nature?
I think that it's a couple things. I think the gay community has money.
That's true, too.
And I think that they have more influence in elections than they used to because they have money.
Yeah.
And I think the community is very organized. And I think that's a big part of it, sadly. I mean,
the gay community has money.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Particularly gay men have money. They have a lot of expendable income. They don't have kids a lot of times.
So they're willing, but what you mean is they're willing to donate this money to advocates.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And beyond that, I think, I mean, they're huge. They were huge supporters of Obama.
Yeah.
Like, huge. He couldn't afford to tick them off at all. And beyond that, I think that...
even though Obama was coy forever about whether he supported marriage equality.
People knew what
that was getting to the breaking point. But prior to that, he did all this other stuff. Like, gay marriage was not the only thing. Remember, don't forget about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That was huge.
Yeah, it's true.
And he did other stuff on hate crimes and employment. He more recently did stuff on employment discrimination. I mean, he's just, like, done all kinds of stuff on LGBT rights, way more than just same-sex marriage stuff. So beyond the money aspect of it, I think that it's interesting when conservatives come into this, because conservatives, true conservatives, want less government. And they'll start arguing that, you know, why should the government, you know, be stepping in and determining marriage laws and, you know, stay out of it, let people do what they want. And so there's a weird faction like Dick Cheney. Like, you have weird people from the right who are like, I got no problem with gay marriage.
It's kind of holdover from the way Barry Goldwater felt.
Yeah, it's like old school conservatives. So it's just, and then there's just, between those two things happening, I think, I don't know, it's becoming more visible in media, and people are just becoming more familiar with gay issues and gay people, and put that all together, and it's a big step forward.
And younger generations see the issue of discriminating against gays as ridiculous.
Well, even Obama has said, like, he was sitting at his dinner table with his family, and one of his daughters was, like, talking about her gay friend, and he was just, like no big deal at all. And he was just kind of, you know, taking it all in, like, wow, like, that's so different from when I was a kid, you know, and she's just telling a story, and that's just, like, an aside. My friend at school, he's gay anyway, blah, 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 you know? It's just, it is generational, for sure.
So this, I wonder if you use the term death rattle to describe the way Mike Pence was complaining that he was the victim of intolerance. But it seems like this whole RFRA episode is a death rattle of anti-gay.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I keep coming back to is that the main group of people who oppose things like marriage equality, they share something in common. They're really old. And so the biggest limit to continuing these kind of discriminatory practices and this sort of, you know, I call it homophobic statecraft, is that, you know, in a generation's time, there just won't be enough people left to believe that.
Oh, that was more literal than
I thought.
So,
yeah, it is. Yeah, no. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, literally was talking
man.
About
I didn't know
mortality.
We were, I didn't want, oh, geez.
All right.
Death.
We're all going to die. That's just basically, basically we all die and our great works pass from this earth. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. All right, so we're going to talk about something else that was big this week. It's something I hate.
Jason, you weren't in the office on
Wednesday.
I wasn't
in the office. I am totally intolerant, okay? I'm a bigot. I'm a bigot against April Fools.
Oh, wow.
People who practice April Foolery. And it's weird. My transformation has been the opposite, because for a long time I was kind of like, yeah, April Fool's jokes are okay. I even participated in a few myself. But I've come to realize that April Fool's Day is a scourge against humanity, and I no longer support it.
It sounds like you had a bad experience.
We had a bad experience here in this office. We learned through experience.
Which was the bad one? Is this the Sam?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, this is a we're here today. You know, we're gonna get a little bit personal, but we're also gonna, I think, provide everyone with a cautionary tale against April Fool's jokes. It's when foolery goes bad. You know, I'm reminded this actually was 4 years ago.
This was 2011.
2011. That's it's crazy how much it burns.
And every year you take the day off. when it falls on a weekday.
Well, yeah, and lucky me, that's only like literally happened like one or two times since then.
I got a haircut. I left.
Yeah, too. I don't come to the office anymore because I just don't trust it.
It's not safe. It's not a safe space.
It's completely not safe. It's completely not safe. So 4 years ago, you know, 5 years ago here in this office, we thought we were pretty good practical jokesters. We actually managed to convince the editors in New York that we had authentically obtained a guest post from LL Cool J.
Which is not even that far-fetched to me.
It's totally...
But it was wacky at the time.
It's absolutely not far-fetched. The whole idea is like, hey, LL Cool J wants to write something for us. Are you guys interested in it? Of course, everyone's like, yeah, shit, that sounds great. So we covered ourselves. We actually wrote something that plausibly sounded like LL Cool J. And, like, you know, we didn't mistreat LL Cool J, but we, like, really thought about the kind of thing he'd be interested in talking about. And like how we would write a blog post for us, and we created it, and it was sufficiently plausible. And then we backed ourselves up by creating like fake email addresses for LL Cool J's literary agent and stuff like that. And like literally, this thing was about to go live onto the website when we said, "Okay, it's a joke. Don't put it up there. Don't put it up there." You know, and like you see, there was the fun, and then there was the restraint, and then the next year, the practical jokers in this office lost sight of the restraint very badly.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I think it started with Sam Stein getting upset at his desk.
Yes, yeah. So this is the joke that went wrong 4 years ago. Sam Stein, our wonderful reporter here, got upset with another one of our colleagues, Shaheen Nasirapour, our very easygoing, fun-loving, not at all hot-headed economic reporter. They had staged this fight between them, like a super hot, crazy fight.
This was the month Jen Bendery started.
It started
a week after this.
I was just talking to Dave Jameson, who covers labor for us. He started 2 days after this happened. Like, he walked into an environment where we're all still very emotionally scarred. So they had a huge fight, and it was plausible that they might be fighting because they had had a tiff some years back.
They
expertly planted their fake fight in that tiff.
They had a real fight at a massive like lunch meeting with Arianna Huffington and all the editors assembled in the room.
Yeah.
And Shaheen just said he bitched us out on the politics team. He was on the business team.
Yeah.
He thought our coverage was frivolous.
And we were like, nah.
It was like, did you know that you work for the Huffington Post?
Yeah.
But anyway.
It was pretty funny.
We settled it.
Yeah, that beef got quashed. But it wasn't quashed sufficiently that we thought that when they started fighting again, we all sort of like saw it as an extension of this previous fight that they had had. And man, this thing got out of hand quickly because like what we were hearing in the office, and you have to understand, this is the perspective of being in the same office as these people working alongside them. What we were hearing from Sam was that Shaheen was on the warpath, super mad at Sam for something he did. I can't remember. It was like a story he would or wouldn't write or edit. And like Shaheen had laid down an ultimatum that like if this wasn't dealt with, Shaheen was quitting. Like it was extreme and emotional and weird. And like over the period of like several hours, they sort of like nurtured this act.
Well, Sam forwarded us the email and everything.
Yeah.
It was to the editor in New York, Tim O'Brien, from Shaheen. Said, Tim, as you are undoubtedly aware, lately Sam and I have not been seeing eye to eye on many matters. I'm reading the email. And it's a continuation of a subtle feud that has lasted for months, and it predates you, Tim O'Brien. I can't take it anymore. He now attempts to direct our business coverage. even after I've told to butt out of politics coverage. He belittles me privately and worse, crows about this to his sources. Word has gotten around. So this may have been, you know, they both were dealing with the White House.
Yeah.
And so maybe something had gotten around. While I don't want to be drastic, frankly, I see no alternative. It's me or him.
Yeah, yeah. So that's...
If you want to keep Sam, I'll be disappointed, but we'll respect your decision. Please let me know so I can commence my search for employment elsewhere.
So Sam Stein... Wow. Okay, Shaheen was out of our office. He was working in New York at the time. Sam Stein was in the office, and I have to say, I have a MFA, okay, in theater. Okay, I've acted. Feel like I know what I'm doing when I'm acting on stage. And like the brutalest part of this April Fool's joke was learning that like Sam Stein was 30,000 times the actor I ever was, because he nurtured this hurt and this anger, and he projected it so well that we're all, well, not all, Arthur Delaney sitting here admirably refused to believe that this was real.
Well, why?
Insisting it was April Fool's Day.
Well,
and I wanted to believe
it was
you
April
too.
Fool's Day.
Of course it was. I wanted to believe you too. But the coup de grace to me was like, finally what happened was that Tim O'Brien was like, I'm putting both of you on the phone and we're going to settle this.
And we weren't invited to the room, but we happened. They rigged it so we happened to like hear
it. Sam was like, we're going to talk about it in the conference room. And we all sort of migrated because we're also emotionally invested in what we thought was maybe real, that we all were listening in on this conference call. And none of us stopped to think, why would they do this on speakerphone? Because we're idiots. And like essentially, Tim O'Brien decided right then and there that Sam was fired. And like, so we all, not all, I want to say we, not all, most of us thought, holy crap. Sam Stein, the guy who's been working in this bureau since its beginning, has been fired. We were crazy with like rage and confusion. I was upset. Zach Carter, who usually joins us in this podcast, was super upset.
You guys were about to jump off the roof.
We were really mad. We were really mad. Ryan Grimm, our bureau chief, who I still don't know if at the time he said this he was in on the joke or not in on the joke.
He said he wasn't, but I think he was.
He said if they go through with this, we're all walking off. And I was like, Christ.
Oh my
God. I was like, okay, so principle guides me to say, well, if they fire Sam for this, I should walk off. I should walk off and protest. But I didn't want to go home to my wife and say, so, honey, guess what? We're not going to make rent this week because I quit my job because of this nonsense. You know, I was just thinking she probably would be like, you go back and get your fucking job.
I signed Ryan's letter. I think it was an actual
letter. It was a letter?
Yes, there was an actual letter.
I signed it maintaining this isn't really happening, but yeah. Yeah, Ryan, sure, I'll quit too. And I was in the back of my mind like, oh man, I don't want to lose my job.
It got crazy out of hand. It got crazy out of hand. And Arthur, you were saying earlier that like what really hurt was that as someone who like absolutely sussed it out as a prank, you didn't actually benefit from the knowledge that it was a prank.
Well, I didn't, the crucial link was that I thought it was a prank on Sam.
Yes.
I didn't know it was actually Sam pranking us.
Yeah, and none of us could have conceived that Tim O'Brien would agree to play a part in a prank this serious. He was like one of our top editors. We didn't think for a second he would agree to be on this joke. But the thing is that every person we turned to like settle this, and none of us had the foresight to actually call Ariana and have her settle this because we're idiots.
Why would we?
Was she in on it?
No, she wasn't in on it.
But
she made me finding him out for the first time.
I reached out to senior managers in New York and say, hey, listen, all day long this prank has been going on. It's getting out of hand. People are really upset. People are talking about quitting. Can you please talk to Tim and like get them to call it off?
Yeah.
And each time I did this, the person I contacted would go over and then just be brought into the fold of the prank.
Yeah.
So it kept growing.
Yeah. It got super out of hand. Eventually, they let us all off the hook.
So how long did it go on in total?
It went on for an entire day.
It was at least an entire afternoon. It consumed the day. And it was people were shaking.
It consumed our lives for an afternoon, but you have to understand that, like, this began that morning.
Yeah.
Like, the seeds were planted.
So when the truth finally came out, how did people react?
I was pissed off.
Angry. He's still angry to this day. Doesn't work on April Fool's Day.
Yeah, I don't work on April Fool's Day. I don't participate in April Fool's anymore.
Did Sam and Shaheen think they were like the funniest people in the world?
Yes. Yes, they still do. They still think this is genius, a masterstroke. And like, you know, you told me Monday that Sam and Nico had been talking just about pranks in general.
Oh yeah, we had to get our guard up. Sam was told me, I just saw this great movie called Windy City Heat, which was a prank movie. He said he happened to mention that Nico Pitney had emailed him about it. So I said, so you and Nico have been emailing about pranks?
Yeah, yeah. On the 30th of March.
And then Sam was like, let's do a prank. Let's get somebody.
Red flag.
I said, Sam, forget it. Don't try to get me to let my guard down with some fake prank you want to play on somebody else as just a trick so that I am ultimately pranked.
Can I just say?
So I went and got a haircut.
When you've been inside the dark side of April Fool's Day, it does change your life. Like, I can't be sure if I was or wasn't pranked yesterday. I can't be sure that anything's real.
Yeah.
You know? Like, even though I took the day off, like, I kept imagining, it was like, well, they could be doing something at my desk. They could be doing something at my computer. You know?
Yeah, and for somebody who's already concerned,
they could be Windy City heating me right now.
You don't know whether what you're experiencing is reality. And this just pushes you further into the shadows, and you really don't know if anything is real. It shakes you in an existential way.
Yeah. It was kind of strange this time, too, because Senator Menendez has been indicted, and that was playing out right around all of this. And so are the Iran nuclear talks. The deadline was pushed to April 1st.
Was Senator Menendez indicted, or was that a prank?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, it just all fell on this. All these big things fell on April Fool's Day.
All day long, you couldn't trust a single thing you saw on Facebook because, like, brands were, like, putting stuff in your Facebook feed about, hey, we invented this thing. And it was like, oh, is that real? No, it's a prank. A real thing that got invented by Amazon, this weird button you can put in, like, your dryer to, like, Wi-Fi signal for more dryer sheets or detergent. People were like, oh, that's just a prank. And it was that's a real thing.
I still think it's a prank.
I still think it's a prank, too. That's the thing. That's the thing. I don't know. I just don't know. It's weird. Every time April Fool's Day comes up for me, I enter this period of time where I just can't be sure anything is real. I feel like I'm inside, like, the Inception dream. I don't know. So, I mean, I just want to say, people, we need to stop April Fool's Day. It's not a holiday, and it's not fun. And the internet has, if anything, made it terrible. Whatever it was before, John Oliver stood.
Well, hang on a second.
Right to have done so.
There was a well-executed, harmless April Fool's that Jen wrote about.
You people are the worst.
The acronym.
This is how it starts.
That's harmless.
Just briefly explain it. I think it was an example of April Fool's done right.
A congressman put out a statement, Congressman Mike Honda from California, saying he had filed a bill called the Acronym Act. Acronym itself was an acronym for a very long word. Then, and in his press release, he said that the point of the bill was to prohibit any bills that unnecessarily add words to the bill titles so they can make an acronym out of the bill name.
It was the Accountability and Congressional Responsibility on Naming Your Motions Act.
Yes. And he put it out, and it was hilarious. I mean, I for a split second believed it. And I was like, oh, April Fool's Congressman.
The funny thing is, as a piece of legislation, it is as meritorious as many,
and it could
as
have
many
been,
bills introduced by backbenchers,
and it no could prospects. Have been introduced on any other fucking day.
Nobody got
See,
hurt.
See, this is how we never let these monsters die. Is when we say, "Oh, but that one thing they did on April Fool's was great." It wasn't. If it was great, it would have been funny.
All right, all right.
I think I'm with Arthur on this one. If nobody gets hurt,
yeah,
go for it.
Nobody like it's
clearly
not
our entire office got hurt 4 years ago.
Yeah, that was a prank in the sense that, like, you punch somebody in the face and say, ha ha, and you laugh at their misfortune.
Well,
you laugh at their anguish.
I guess for some reason, this debate is just going to have to continue. I really thought I would settle it today.
Sorry.
All right. Well, let's talk about something else that we probably won't settle today. Homelessness.
Yes.
Homelessness, still a big thing. Housing, still a major concern for people. And Arthur, you wrote a story about You've been writing some really great stories about homelessness lately, but tell us about your most recent story.
They have a way to, at least this is how it seems, theoretically, we can end the chronic homelessness. Not all homelessness. I think most homelessness is caused by economic factors, job loss, insufficient pay, relationship problems.
The degradation of mental health services.
Well, no, now that is the one where a solution seems to have been found.
Oh, really?
These are the most visible homeless people. I just wanted to point out that, you know, people who are couch surfing, 7 million Americans at risk of being evicted, it doesn't miraculously take away the threat of losing your place of living. But anyway, for homeless people on the street who seem crazy or seem like they're on drugs, they found a way. This has been a problem in this country since the 80s, really, after involuntary commitment of mental patients really ended as a thing. And people were on the streets, and it was a little crisis. And there since then had been an ad hoc system of emergency shelter. And now, since the 90s, when this group called Pathways to Housing in New York pioneered a housing-first approach where instead of saying, hey, take your medication, sober up, or anything like that, they just hand over the keys to an apartment. And that is the best way to keep those people off the street.
And I mean, do they get help beyond just like once they're in their apartment?
Yes, but it's not a condition of remaining housed. They just have to obey the terms of their lease. But yeah, the idea is then after you're in there, we will take care of you to whatever extent you're willing to let us.
Yeah.
And it's been studied over and over independently and found to both reduce homelessness among targeted people by a much greater extent than other programs with sobriety prerequisites say. And also, and this is the neat thing about it, costs less money.
Ah.
Because the trick is, well, people say, give the homeless homes. If you've got $1 billion laying around, that'll be a great way to solve the problem. But what people don't realize, because the costs are externalized from various groups, that leaving people on the streets is actually very expensive because they wind up in jail and in hospitals and other places where, you know, it costs a lot of money to run the place.
It seems to me that one of the critical impediments you have if you are someone who's attempting to intervene with someone who needs medical intervention for mental illness, that just the sheer fact that you cannot find them on a regular basis, regular consistent basis, is problematic. I remember being up in New York I think 2 weeks before the Republican National Convention was in New York City several years ago, and I was there a few weeks before, and I remember reading a Village Voice article at the time talking about how what the city had done is basically come in and like essentially swept all the homeless people away.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the medical professionals and homelessness advocates who essentially spent most of their week reaching out to people living on the street, building a rapport with them, earning their trust so that then they can like slowly help and intervene with the problems they had. Suddenly, all of their contacts were gone. They couldn't find anyone they had been talking to. And they knew that once they managed to reestablish contact, if they were to be that lucky, they would have to re-embark on the entire relationship building because those people had been traumatically removed from the places they had been and perhaps put in some kind of facility. And so the level of trust they had in anyone approaching them would have been vastly diminished. They talked about how they're going to have to like essentially start all over.
That really illustrates why leaving people on the streets doesn't work. Because if you have no stability, how are you going to keep taking your medication? How will you keep it if it's in a bag by a park bench and all of a sudden you're told to get lost by police and you're separated from the bag?
Yeah.
You're not going to get better that way. So this works. How do they find people? People are in the woods. They do outreach, like in shelters, of course, but also they go to the parks. They go to these out-of-the-way places, like under overpasses and in the woods, I think, to some extent. And, you know, people, even people who live in the woods are not always there. The guy I profiled for a story last week had lived, he said, in the woods for about 20 years in Prince George's, Maryland. And he met an outreach worker when he happened to be in a shelter, and he heard the person saying, like, I'm looking for veterans. We'll give you an apartment. So it was this promise of a place to live of your choosing, not in a shelter, not in a building that's just for homeless people, but you know, somewhere in a neighborhood, and even a nice neighborhood in a normal apartment. And he has one, and he's been there for more than 2 years, and it's a pretty good place. I saw it, and he's up front like, yeah, I hear voices that are you know, threatening and bad, but at least now I'm not going to drink a bottle of Seagram's.
Right.
I can stay in here, and I can take a shower or, you know, clean the kitchen.
Does he recognize that he has a mental illness?
Yes, and you know, he's totally upfront about it. He said it.
This is the subject of your story.
Yeah, his name is Mark Thompson, and he's 55. And he said, "Yeah, all that time in the woods, I think when I was just drinking, he was alone a lot because he was miserable." He said he thinks that he started hearing voices as a result of that, which I don't think is an totally unusual way for a person to develop schizophrenia. But anyway, he's got a real handle on it. I mean, some people can hear voices and not realize that they're hearing voices, but he can.
I know that there are communities now that are taking a sort of a housing first approach to the homeless, regardless of whether they are mentally ill or not. And the argument is that it's cost effective.
Yeah.
I suppose that the argument against it is like, oh, well, you're just breeding dependents. They're moochers.
Yeah, it's just an intuitive, old-fashioned argument that if you're just going to give people stuff, it's not going to help them get better. And at least in the case of these chronically homeless people, it's that logic has failed.
Yeah.
And Housing First, at least so far, has not failed, has been proven over and over to be pretty good. But, like, I did a long story in Florida where they're constantly finding new ways to arrest homeless people, and that viewpoint really, even though Housing First is popular in the upper echelons of the federal government, on the ground in towns across the country, it's just like, oh, we gotta make it illegal to lie down, we gotta buy people bus tickets out of town, we need to outlaw blankets, it's stuff like that.
Right.
So Housing First is nowhere near, I don't think. Well, actually, they do think they'll get chronic homelessness ended, you know, within the near future. But it's not like you look at DC, where we have, because of high rent and lack of high paying jobs, hundreds of families homeless all the time and filling up our shelter and in motels, because DC is an unusual city that guarantees shelter. The Housing First principle is to just rapidly put people back in housing, but getting it up to scale for people who aren't mentally ill and chronically homeless seems to be a real challenge and not something that's about to happen. Because even if you want to do that, where are you going to find the apartments?
Yeah.
It's going to be really expensive in that case, contrary to where you're saving money on all these ER and jail visits.
What, you know, one of the things is that it's getting so difficult to actually secure, if you're working class, middle class, and you live in one of these big cities, it's getting more and more difficult to actually secure just an affordable rent you can live in yourself. I worry that, like, someday you're going to see people actually building Housing First apartment arrangements for chronically homeless people, because the bootstrap argument does fall in a hole when you can't secure your stuff and take a shower and have a nice,
you've got nowhere to put job your bootstraps. Yeah.
Right, nowhere to put your bootstraps. But I worry that, like, one day we'll have, like, a you know, an apartment building that's built, you know, to do Housing First homelessness intervention, and there's going to be a ton of working class people who will be like, but I'll happily pay a higher rent to have that space. Right.
That's like, I feel like DC encapsulated right now is the, on 14th Street, there was that homeless shelter
Yes, on 14th, Central Union Mission.
A big one, right? And
yep.
And they bulldozed it and turned it into condos. And
they didn't bulldoze it. The main structure is still around.
Oh, okay. Then they just must have revamped it because it was all covered up. And
they're super nice condos.
And yeah, what's like high-end condos.
What's curiously ironic about that is that you still know it's a Central Union Mission if you walk down 14th Street toward the White House, in the direction of the White House, because up on the top facade it says, unto me,
yeah.
Which was the thing that designated as a...
Like, where did those people go?
I think they went elsewhere. They were talking about building a new homeless shelter up on Florida Avenue, but of course NIMBYism, I think, imperiled that.
Yeah, they're trying to shift away from the big shelters and more toward apartments.
Yeah,
in general, which reflects the housing first entrenchment. We still have the biggest homeless shelter in America. The Federal City Shelter in downtown DC has more than 1,000 people in it.
Wow.
Every night.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing contrast here, like the Potomac Gardens housing project in Southeast DC. There is now, on the same block as this, like right next to it, up went $200,000 per unit condo building.
Yeah.
It's like in the fence of the projects.
Yeah. That that particular space on 14th Street, man, is it riven with irony for me.
Yes.
You can now, the retention of the come unto me sign on the top, that's driven by nostalgia for what the building used to be. What the building used to be was a space for very poor people, very destitute people to have a tiny bit of dignity. So now you can own a super expensive condominium in D.C. that is inscribed with a beacon from the Lord to the poor and destitute to come there. Wow. It's America. Anyway, thanks for joining us, guys. You can follow Arthur, their senior reporter for the Huffington Post, on Twitter, at Arthur Delaney, HP. H is in Harry, P is in Potter.
Please follow me. I'm dying to have more followers.
You can follow Jen Bendery, our White House correspondent, at J Bendery, B-E-N-D-E-R-Y. You can follow me at Deceiver, D-C as in Washington, D-C, E-I-V-E-R. I won't deceive you. That's just a nickname. All right, good night. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Jen Bendery and Arthur Delaney. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, we thank you very much for listening, and we miss you already.